Welcome to a four-part special QualityCast North series celebrating the 25th anniversary of the Royal Commission into the Future of Healthcare in Canada and the subsequent report generated by Roe Romano. Casting today from the traditional lands of the Clai-Te-Kaine and Silks First Nations is regular host Cher Chewy and our special series co-host, Dr. Aiko Wider. Our next guest in this special series is Gregory Marshildon, Professor Emeritus at the Institute of Health Policy, Management and Evaluation at the University of Toronto, and who was the Chief of Staff to Roy Romano during the Royal Commission, working closely alongside him in producing his report. He's also the author of the book, Tommy Douglas and the Quest for Medicare in Canada. Welcome, Greg. Thank you for joining us today.
Great pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Now, before we get into it, here's a short archive clip of you and Roy talking about the commission and Roy's role as commissioner.
What did you find out early on in the Royal Commission? As you will no doubt remember, we were testing public opinion, testing views of Canadians across the country. Can you tell us a little bit about what you found out from that?
As I look back at it now, I think I was determined, or had determined, I'll put it that way, in my mind, that Medicare had lost the popularity that it had received initially in Saskatchewan and later federally. And a lot of it was due to the fact that the delivery of healthcare had changed dramatically too. Pharma was a very big expense feature, not covered, still isn't covered. Particularly, and on it goes, home care and you name it. So we had to bring it up to date. Cristiano and the feds had to bring it up to date. So that's the thing that really impressed me the most, was the fact that we did not have an updated version of what was required. And while I wanted to keep my mind open to new ideas, I got to tell you, as I look back at it, I wanted basically, if the evidence supported it, to endorse a publicly funded system, more modern day publicly funded system. I just think the public's turnout, which was in such large numbers, indicated whatever you do, Romano, don't change that single payer system, that it's a basic right of Canadians and the public to have the best healthcare services, medication possible.
Gregory, can you please take us back 25 years and share the state of healthcare and why there was a need for this incredible report?
The reasons were twofold. The first was that there had been a lot of budget cutting due to a public crisis and deficits and debt across the country. And as a consequence, you had provincial governments cutting their budgets, including healthcare budgets, in the early to mid-1990s. And a number of reforms were implemented across the country. At the same time, the federal government also cut its transfers to the provincial governments by a very substantial amount. And this occurred after a lot of the provincial cuts occurred. So, this created a situation in which you had both very positive reforms going on in that governments were finally pushed to do the things they probably should have done 20 years earlier, including the creation of health authorities to actually manage the system. Before that, provincial governments just paid hospitals and paid doctors without trying to manage it as a system. This forced them to think about managing the system. The negative part was that there was a decline in terms of infrastructure investment. There was efforts to hold back providers for many years, and that created great dissatisfaction, particularly among doctors and nurses. Some doctors actually left the country at the time. So that was one set of reasons. The second set of reasons was that with the cut in the transfers, the federal government also was no longer providing any kind of escalator formula for the health transfers to provinces. And as a consequence, the provinces and the provincial governments began to use that as a lever to demand federal provincial meetings in which they would get more money for health care. That wasn't the only reason the provincial governments wanted money from the federal government, but health was the most sort of convenient hat that they could use to get the to basically pressure the federal government. So it all became about healthcare funding in sort of the language that was used at the time. But the reality is that the provinces were looking for an increase in transfers generally. It was widely perceived that there was a bit of a crisis by the end of the 1990s. And some provinces were looking to do all kinds of things, including breaking with the Canada Health Act and basically pushing their problem into the private sphere and forcing citizens to purchase private health insurance or just pay out of pocket for certain services that had previously been provided publicly. So that was the issue.
Thank you. So, Greg, for you, what were the key findings and recommendations from that report?
Well, let me start with findings. First, that there was an east-west gradient in terms of the country. There were quite important differences between Atlantic Canada and to some extent Quebec and the rest of the country, that things seemed to be sort of more flush, if I can put it that way, in the rest of Canada. Well, a national program in a sense, but there were differences. And coverage was a little more sparse, for example, in Atlantic Canada than it was in the rest of Canada. Second thing is the extent to which primary health care is a gateway to the system, an extremely critical one, and the importance of both expanding and improving upon it, that no high-performing health system exists without extremely good primary health care. And Canada was lagging behind a number of other countries in this respect. So those were some key findings. In terms of the recommendation, it was decided that basically that there needed to be an effort made by all provincial governments in improving primary health care, in changing the modes of practice, in ensuring that people received a broader array of services to prevent unnecessary referrals, to ensure that there wouldn't be, in a sense, improper prescriptions, to deal with chronic care over long periods of time for conditions that can only be managed. They can't be magically, in a sense, that they will never disappear, but they need to be properly managed. The next recommendation involved one that took up a chapter, was the most ignored chapter in the Romano report, which was on Indigenous health care and the extent to which that was an area that needed to be addressed. We basically had two systems in place. Medicare was basically all Indigenous people are treated as residents of provinces or territories for the purposes of Medicare, therefore get their services from the provincial governments, but the provincial governments had never provided services, for example, on reserves or in remote areas. And therefore, there was problems in terms of accessing services by Canada's most vulnerable population. So that was highly problematic, and that needed to be addressed. And the second thing is the whole issue of the way in which the services are provided and encompassing Indigenous ways of healing and knowing, and the option of having, for example, primary clinics that would be Indigenous health clinics that would, in a sense, emerge on a community-based manner.
You talk about this as if you wrote this thing yesterday. It's incredible you're still completely attuned with this work. It's actually wonderful to hear you talk about it.
I've been dealing with issues in healthcare since that time, and they're the same issues. And my only sort of disappointment is if we had dealt with some of them earlier, we wouldn't still dealing with them now, first of all. Second of all, some of the problems have actually gotten worse. And, you know, that creates an additional dilemma because as people lose confidence in the system, the tendency will be to say, well, let's just give up on all of it.
While you were putting together the report, while you were doing carrying out the inquiry, what did you find were the biggest challenges in doing this work and writing the report?
Well, the first was time. The Prime Minister and the Federal Cabinet were very desirous of a Royal Commission that would report within 18 months. There had never been a previous Royal Commission that had less than 3 years to do its work. And to have 18 months was highly challenging, but we could not. I was negotiating the mandate in Ottawa on behalf of Mr. Romanow, and it took me 2 weeks worth of negotiations, but that was one area that would not move. The Prime Minister was adamant this had to be done in 18 months. In retrospect, I realized that he wasn't sure that he had more than about 18 months left in office. At the time, he wasn't sure about how much longer he would be around. And so I think that was, I'm guessing that might have motivated him, but I can only guess because that was never, we never discussed why that was the case, except that he did mention to me and to Mr. Romanow that he had very terrible experiences with royal commissions in the past, that they were always way over time. They were way over budget, and they always exceeded or did something other than their mandate. And this time he wanted it on time, on budget, and stay within the mandate. And he trusted Mr. Romanow to do that. But he would not trust anyone else. He did not want to set up a commission behind Mr. Romanow. Mr. Romanow was the sole commissioner. Unlike previous royal commissions, all of which had at least three or more commissioners involved, many times a half a dozen or more. But in this case, Mr. Romanow was basically asked to do it and because of the trust between the two. And their relationship went back a very long time, and they worked together extensively for years. And it didn't matter that they came from different political parties. They trusted each other through and through. And so it was that that really created the dilemma because Mr. Romanow said to me, he said, I know it's going to be difficult, but the Prime Minister and the federal government would not be asking us to do this within that time unless there was a very good reason. The other aspect of that was that we really need to figure out where Canadians were at, because whatever the values were of Canadians and what they wanted when Medicare was created in the 1950s and 60s, that might not be true in the early part of the 21st century. So we needed to figure that out. So we also, in addition to getting the public opinion survey that would bring everything up to date. And there were other public opinion, but we really wanted to go down deep. So we got a really good one done on our behalf. In addition, the citizens' dialogue really, really, you know, when you have people together over an entire day and they get to know each other and they're from very different walks of life and they have to come to sort of a resolution in terms of what would be best for everyone, not just for themselves. And knowing other people's challenges around the table after some discussions, that was our best guide to the values of Canadians. And we really depended heavily on it. And because of the selection process, we could say there was much more of a scientific basis to it than any public opinion survey.
How did Roy Romanow's report go down with the First Ministers after it was released?
Well, we had ongoing relations with all of the first ministers in the country, their governments throughout. We had a little federal provincial division within the commission that, you know, where we reached out. We knew there was a fair amount of hostility among some premiers or great differences in terms of what they wanted to see come out of the report. And the reaction was not surprising. There were some premiers that dismissed the report out of hand. There were others that welcomed it and said it was extremely good. And there were others that just said, well, the Romanow gap we'll use that. They didn't really care about the rest of the report. So it was a bit mixed up, but the reaction generally was highly polarized. I would say that the majority of the Canadian public were very positive, in part because they felt that they had been included. The public consultations really, in a sense, gave them an opportunity, and not just the public hearings, but in other venues and forums, to basically tell the commission what they were thinking, and they felt reflected in the report.
What were other elements that you felt were key drivers of the execution of this work, which was, very, very energetic volume of work to be done in 18 months?
I think we felt at the time that we were at a crossroads. Certainly, Mr. Romano and I felt that. We felt that because I was his deputy minister in the provincial government when he was premier, and I was always with him at first minister's meetings and premier's meetings. And whether it was an annual premier's conference or a first minister's meeting, it seemed like everybody was beginning to go their own way in this area. And it seemed that the federal government was letting it happen. This was upsetting to Mr. Romano, who is, he's a great Canadian patriot who felt that this was a really critical element of the Canadian identity. And if we lost it, it would be tragic. And was, Mr. Cushion was his friend, but he wanted the federal government to take heed. So while he was premier, he spoke to Mr. Kretchen about this, and he said, really, you need to set up a federal royal commission so that we don't sort of all go off on our own ways. And then by that time that the federal government's willing to move, it's too late. But Mr. Kretchen didn't quite agree with him at that point. And I think that he changed his mind, but only after Mr. Romano left office. So I left office, Mr. Romano left office, and I thought I was going back to university life. Mr. Romano was trying to figure out what he wanted to do next and, was beginning to do some things at the university as well. And the next thing I know is Mr. Kretchen calls him and tells him that, this idea of a royal commission is pretty good. And now that you're no longer premier, you can be the chair of it. The idea was that it was time for there to be something national. It needed to be independent of the federal government, therefore it needed to be a royal commission, but it needed to be national. For Mr. Romano, that was the single most important point. We needed to get our act together as a country.
One of the themes that comes out very, very clearly through the report is this idea of tying Canadians' identity to the principle of universal healthcare. And I wonder whether you can tell us, what inspired Roy to do this, to make this link? Was it something that clearly came out through the inquiry process, or did he make a conscious decision to tie that Canadian identity with universal healthcare?
I think it was the former. Now, clearly he felt it himself, and he had felt it since 1962 as a young law student who saw the doctor strike and actually tried to help the government of the day introduce the medical care plan in the face of a 23-day doctor strike. And he was profoundly affected by that, as well as profoundly affected by Tommy Douglas, who he introduced at the University of Saskatchewan when he spoke on the issue of Medicare. By that time, Tommy Douglas was federal leader, but Douglas was already speaking about this as this should be part of the Canadian identity. Yes, it was a Saskatchewan plan, but he wanted it to become national and that it would, in a sense, set us apart as a more civilized nation if we could accomplish this. He believed that, but he didn't. He's not a vain person. He did not believe that this was what everybody else thought. And in fact, he knew plenty of individuals who didn't believe it, right? But what he wanted to know was, what does the general public really think about this? And he told me right at the beginning of the committee, we'd have long conversations. He said, yeah, he says, I know. He says, I know what people thought then. He says, but do they still believe that? And I said, you know, we'll have to figure that out. We don't know. So that's why we did the major public opinion survey. And then most important of all, that citizens' dialogue. Obviously, to Mr. Romano's great relief, it reflected that plus more. It revealed the fact that this was people wanted Medicare to continue, not just for themselves, not just out of a selfish desire to have what they, you know, free health care at the point of delivery, but they wanted it for people they didn't know. They wanted the security of knowing that everybody around them had it.
I wonder whether you can cast your mind back and whether you're willing to share something personal that you still remember clearly from that time that you spent with Roy working on the commission all those years ago.
Well, the first thing I remember is during the time of the public hearings, we had to begin to work on the final report. And because of previous experience with him, I knew the best way to do that was like in a series of briefing papers on individual issues in which options would be set out. And then, of course, if I was doing the paper, would make a recommendation, but it was up to him to go through the options and to make a final decision as to what he wanted. And then it would be put into prose form for the purposes of the report. But that created a bit of a dilemma because what we had received through the research, through even the citizens' dialogue, et cetera, did not always jive with what he was hearing in the public hearings. So he would go back to Saskatoon at the end of the week of public hearings, exhausted. I could hear it in his voice. I was based in Regina. Sometimes I went up to Saskatoon. Sometimes we just spoke for hours on the telephone, where we would review on the weekends the differences between what the expert evidence was saying and what sort of experts would recommend, people like myself, versus what the public was saying. And we'd parse the differences. And then we would say, well, you know, it's not really, it appears to be different, but it's not. And this is how it fits together. And so it was like sort of working on a Rubik's Cube. And then what that was doing was clarifying Mr. Romano's mind as to what he wanted to recommend. These conversations would go on, and, you know, sometimes we'd say we'd set aside 3 hours and it would go for 6 hours or it'd go for 8 hours. I'll never forget that because he was exhausted. I was exhausted, but we had to do this.
Thank you, Gregory. Like, I mean, this has just been such a wonderful, fascinating conversation about the report and your journey with Mr. Romano. And you had mentioned Tommy Douglas, and of course, I would consider you an expert on Tommy Douglas and healthcare. And just in our final closing minutes, maybe just some of your insights into where the overlap was between Tommy Douglas and his thinking and his work and Mr. Romano's report.
Well, first area is that Medicare, as we've come to know it, is only a work in progress. And both Douglas, I know, was very disappointed towards the end of his life that there wasn't any sort of expansion and improvement going on, that people viewed it as a sort of an end product when it wasn't. And that's exactly how Mr. Romano thinks about it. So that there's definitely an overlap. And people use terminology and politics that can be very misleading. And, you know, the word progressive, but progressive means that you're always looking ahead, or it should mean that, and that you always feel that there can be improvements made to the status quo. And I can tell you that that is certainly ground that is the same ground that both people share. And they see governance in that way, that the whole idea of governance is not to manage things, but to improve things. Yes, you have to manage and manage extremely well. Both Douglas and Romano never ran a deficit. They ran governments that were extremely well run, but they did it for a purpose, which was to change the status quo, to improve on past policies. And both had high expectations. And it's a disappointing environment to see one in which we, you know, there's been virtually no change. And in some respects, we've gone a bit backwards. If Douglas was alive today, I can say I'm not just channeling him for my own purposes. I said this in the book. He would be quite disappointed, I think.
Thank you for that. And it's been a really, really fascinating time with you, Gregory. And we'd love to be able to talk for longer about all these things. But we do have to wrap things up. So thank you and good luck with your book. And thank you for joining us today and helping us celebrate 25 years of the Royal Commission and the Romano Report. You've been listening to Gregory Marshildon, Chief of Staff to Roy Romano during the Royal Commission and the author of the book, Tommy Douglas and the Quest for Medicare in Canada. More details about Greg's book and a link to the whole archived interview between Greg and Roy Romano is available in this episode's show notes. QualityCast North is sponsored by the Physician Quality Improvement Initiative, a flagship program of the Specialist Services Committee, a collaboration between the Provincial Ministry of Health and the Doctors of BC with representation from the provincial health authorities. This special series episode was co-produced by Dr. Sher Chewy, Dr. Aiko Wider, and executive producer Amin Handel, with technical support from Matt Walker of Expression North and Stephanie Garraway. Original music by Daniel Chewy. Further information about this series is available in our show notes and on our website at nhpqi.ca/podcast.